Okay, so today we will reformulate general relativity in a more abstract form, namely using frames, you know, where we choose the bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces arbitrarily, and in particular we can choose it in such a way that the metric always takes the form eta mu nu. And we will find that when we re-express general relativity in this way, then it becomes obvious that it is actually a gauge theory. And I will review a little bit what a gauge theory is, what a gauge theory is for electromagnetism and for the weak and for the strong force. Okay, so remember that normally, usually, one reflexively chooses these basis vectors in the tangent and cotangent spaces. And if we do that, then the action of gravity and matter takes this form. Interesting. Okay, so the action depends on the matter fields. And then, as we saw in the lecture of Tuesday, the matter fields, the quantum theory of the matter fields, induces extra terms for the matter action, but it also induces a cosmological constant and the Ricci scalar and higher order curvature terms. The cosmological constant is dominant, it is way too large, and we don't know what to do about this because quantum field theory says it should be really large, experiments say it should be really small. We will leave it for today's lecture. We will leave the cosmological constant out of it. Not that it's mathematically hard to do, but it just makes it a little bit more tedious. And the higher order curvature terms are extremely suppressed. So for regular everyday general relativity, even cosmology, usually that part of the action is enough where we just have the Ricci scalar as the gravitational action. Okay, so we consider the matter action. This would be everything of the standard model of particle physics written covariantly with covariant derivatives and the metric and the Ricci scalar here. Then from this action, we obtain the matter equations of motion by the classical matter equations of motion by setting the functional derivative of the action with respect to the matter fields equal to zero. If we do the functional derivative with respect to the ith species fields, then we obtain the equation of motion for the ith species. Could be a Dirac equation or a Maxwell equation, so something like that, or Klein-Gordon. We can also set the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric equal to zero, and then that gives us the dynamics of space-time. This is the Einstein equation, and it takes this form, as we saw. There could also be a cosmological constant term that would be added here, plus lambda times the metric. Now, this is what we get when we choose these canonical basis vectors. What do we obtain when the Einstein equation is written using a frame where the metric always takes this space-time independent form? And we use the most abstract formulation in terms of tensor-valued forms. So let's do that. We start by choosing a frame, that is to say, a basis in the cotangent space and a basis in the tangent space, in principle, arbitrarily. We could choose those theta to be the dx mu's, and we could choose those e mu to be the d by dx mu's. However, then the choice of bases would be dependent on the choice of coordinate system. We want to free ourselves from that. We want to have a formulation such that, how does this work? Look at this. Okay. Ooh. There's a delay, so it's hard to do this. Okay, so we want to use the freedom to choose the bases independently of the coordinate system, because otherwise, if we always choose those canonical bases with the coordinate system, then these coefficient functions have to change as we change coordinate system. For example, here we could have a tangent vector, which in one coordinate system, the coordinate system of the x mu, would have an expansion in terms of these basis vectors with coefficients psi mu. The same vector in a different coordinate system would be expressed in terms of these basis vectors and therefore with different coordinates. However, if we choose a fixed basis, if we hold the basis fixed irrespective of the coordinate system, then the vector would always have the same coefficients in terms of that basis, no matter what the underlying coordinate system is. So that's what we will do. We will choose a basis in the cotangent space and a basis in the tangent space. And then we can expand a tangent vector at a point or an entire tangent vector field in terms of a linear combination of these basis vectors at every point. And these coefficient functions now describe the tangent vector as a linear combination of these basis vectors. And as we change coordinate system, we are not changing these basis vectors, so we're not changing these coefficient functions, so they're always the same. Now, we can also do the opposite. We can keep the coordinate system fixed and change basis vectors, right? Because these things are completely independent of another. So for example, we say we stay in one coordinate system, and these theta nu here are the basis vectors in the cotangent space, for example. Remember, the basis vectors of the cotangent space have upper indices, so that the coefficient functions have lower indices. So let's say these are the basis vectors we choose. And then we say, oh, I want other basis vectors in the cotangent space. So I write them as a linear combination, the new basis vectors, the primed ones, as a linear combination of the unprimed ones. And the A is a change of basis matrix. This is completely independent of a coordinate system, so we can just hold that fixed. And then correspondingly, if, as we will always do, the basis of cotangent vectors is dual to the basis of the tangent vectors, then we have that they transform with the inverse matrix so that the inner product between the theta and the e is the same as that between the theta prime and the e prime, which is the Kronecker delta. So for example, we have a tangent vector here, and we can write it as a linear combination of these basis vectors, or as a linear combination of the primed basis vectors. And then we see that these coefficients are the coefficients of the vector in the primed basis. So these coefficients here, a matrix acting on a vector, these are the new coefficients of our tangent vector, but now in the new basis. And then we see that, if we change basis in this way, then the coefficients of the same vector change. Even though we haven't changed coordinate system, we've just changed basis. Now, for example, let's consider the curvature two form. Remember how that works? We have, it's a two form, so it feeds on two tangent vectors. Those are the two tangent vectors that describe the parallelogram around which we want to do a parallel transport. And then the value that the curvature two form takes is a matrix with indices mu and nu, and that tells us how much the parallel transported vector is rotating. As we will later see, it's indeed a rotation, it's indeed an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Okay, so we have the curvature two form, and it has this matrix of coefficients. See, this was vectors and covectors, but what about tensor-valued forms? How do they transform? So here we have a contravariant and a covariant index. And the way that they transform is just like, you know, any contravariant, any covariant vector would transform, namely with the matrix and the inverse of the matrix of the change of basis. Again, this is a change in the coefficient matrix of the curvature two form, even though we are not changing coordinates. We're just changing basis. Now, let's look at the connection one form. The connection one form, remember, is just the Christoffel symbol, where the first lower index is interpreted as a one form. Right? So it's twofold covariant, but the lower first lower index is is considered to be a one form. And then we are left with an upper and a lower index of the Christoffel symbol. And what does that do? Well, the Christoffel symbol describes parallel transport. So it's a one form, which means you can feed in a tangent vector, and that's the tangent vector that describes the direction in which you want to parallel transport. And then the two remaining indices, the upper and the lower index, describe a matrix of rotation, infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. So this is going to be infinitesimally Lorentz transform valued. However, we know this thing is not a tensor. And its transformation properties are non-trivial. If you go through all of this, we find that this would be the transformation properties of a tensor, but you know, the Christoffel symbols don't transform tensorially, we also get this. And notice that in here we have the exterior derivative of these matrix coefficient functions. Right? If we tied the choice of bases to the choice of coordinate system, we would get a very similar formula where this matrix A would be the dx mu by dx tilde nu Jacobian matrix. Here it's just some matrix of change of bases. And we can change that matrix of change of bases from point to point. So that matrix has a space-time dependence in general. For example, we can choose to change bases in one location this way, and over there we choose to change the bases not at all, and over here we choose to change the bases in another way. All of that is described by the space-time dependence of that matrix, hence that derivative here. Now in practice, how do we do this? How do we specify a frame? How do we choose a basis in the cotangent space arbitrarily? What we can do there is we can use the basis that comes with the choice of coordinate system as an anchor. You see, every choice of coordinate system comes automatically with the canonical basis of the dxj and the d by dxi. And then the basis that we really want to use, we can express as the change of basis from that one. So if you choose a coordinate system, this basis comes for free. And then we say, yeah, but we don't really want to use that basis. We want to use this basis, which we can choose to have special properties. But to describe which basis that is, we simply write these basis vectors as linear combinations of those basis vectors. Now clearly, if we now change coordinate system, then these guys change, and therefore that matrix changes in order to leave this one the same. Because this should always be the same, no matter what the coordinate system. So those guys change with the coordinate system. This matrix of coefficients aij of x will carry crucial information, because it tells us how the desired basis is related to the coordinate basis. So now let's choose some tetrad basis here, some orthonormal frame. So we choose an orthonormal frame of these theta I x's and their dual basis of the E mu. So we say that a frame, that is to say a choice of basis vectors in the tangent and cotangent spaces, tangent spaces, is orthonormal everywhere, that is to say for all points in the manifold, if when we take the metric tensor, and remember it's twofold covariant, if we feed it two of the new tangent vector, the metric has naturally two lower indices, right? So it's a twofold covariant tensor. And therefore, it eats up two tangent vectors. If we feed the metric two tangent vectors from the new frame, our new basis vectors in the tangent space, then the components that we get, the numbers that we get, should be represented in this matrix here that we know as the metric tensor in Cartesian coordinates in Minkowski space. So this should be just the eta mu nu matrix. Remember that in this course, we use the convention where the minus is up here, not down there. Which means that the frame, we choose the frame in such a way that the metric tensor can be written as minus, and then theta naught tensor theta naught, plus some from 1 to 3, theta I tensor theta I. That's just another way of writing that this is true. How do we know that that's possible? How do we know that at every point in the manifold, we can always, no matter what the space-time is, black holes or an inflationary universe or whatever, how do we know that we can always find, irrespective of a choice of coordinate system that has nothing to do with it, that we can always find a basis in the tangent space and the cotangent space such that the metric tensor takes this form? Well, we know that this is possible because let's pick one point. If we can prove it for an arbitrary point that there is a choice of basis so that the metric takes this form, then we are good. So let's pick an arbitrary point of the manifold, arbitrary point P. And let's say we want to construct now a basis in which the metric looks like this. Well, what we can do is we can pick this point and then construct around this point a Riemann normal coordinate system, a geodesic coordinate system. And remember that at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, the metric tensor takes the form eta mu nu. But only there, only at the origin, not at the neighboring point, but just at the origin it does. Which means that the dx mu and d by dx mu of the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system are in fact the basis vectors that we want. Because at the origin of Riemann normal coordinate system, the canonical d by dxi and dx mu basis vectors of the tangent cotangent space, they have this property. Because at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, we have that. It's the equivalence principle. You're freely falling at that point. So you're not locally seeing the curvature. And you can do that at every point. At every point, you can set up a Riemann normal coordinate system, identify the tangent and cotangent vectors that it has at the origin of that Riemann normal coordinate system. And then these tangent and cotangent basis vectors, we choose to be our thetas and e. Now, is that a unique choice? In other words, are Riemann normal coordinates even unique? Not really, because you can always rotate. See, if you rotate the entire coordinate system, you're still freely falling. Not only can you rotate, you can also go fast, right? So you can have any Lorentz transformation and still have a Riemann normal coordinate system, a Lorentz transformation at the origin. So is it unique? Well, for a given space-time, any orthonormal frame gives a new orthonormal frame by changing the basis with this matrix capital lambda mu nu. So we can change the basis vectors here as long as the matrix is such that these conditions are still preserved. So the uniqueness question is this. If I have such a basis at every point, such that the metric takes this form, is it unique? Or can I change to a new basis, for example, from this basis of the cotangent space to that basis of the cotangent space by some matrix that rearranges the, that changes the basis vectors? Can I do that without spoiling this property? So that the metric, can I do that without the metric being something else now, like the eta mu nu? No, I want it to be the same. So I want that eta mu nu theta prime mu tensor theta prime nu is the same as if I did it with the old basis vectors. Which, if I plug that into here, I obtain this. So what I need is lambdas that obey this condition. So whenever I have a matrix, a 4x4 matrix, which can be space dependent, but whenever I have a 4x4 matrix that maps these basis vectors into new basis vectors such that the 4x4 matrix obeys this condition, in other words, it preserves the eta mu nu matrix, well, then the metric still has that form. But what are these matrices? What are these matrices that have the property that if you apply them to a metric, you get the same metric back? This is the definition of the Lorentz transformations, right? Lorentz transformations are linear transformations that preserve the metric. What that means is that tetrads are unique up to local Lorentz transformations. Once you have a tetrad frame, so you have chosen tangent and cotangent vector bases all over the manifold, you can always change your mind with local Lorentz transformations and still get another tetrad, orthonormal tetrad, that is such that the metric takes the simple form eta. Okay, so these frames are unique up to local Lorentz transformation. And local is important, right? It means we can do a local, we can do a Lorentz transformation here, but not there, a larger, a smaller Lorentz transformation, and so on. And remember, Lorentz transformations include not just rotations, but also boosts, but not translations. Those would be Poincaré transformations. And, oh. Uh-huh. Ah. I see. Okay. Well, so many different choices here on these buttons. Okay, so now we know how to define a frame, and we know about its non-uniqueness. Now, let's re-express the degrees of freedom of gravity. Let's re-express them using this new mathematical machinery. How did we use to describe gravity? We used to describe it through these data. We said we had a differential manifold, and we put a metric tensor on it. Implicit in this was that we chose the basis and the tangent and cotangent spaces that came with the coordinate system. In that case, the G was a non-trivial function of space and time. It was a non-trivial 4x4 matrix. It was a function of time. But this can no longer be the description, because the G now becomes just eta mu nu everywhere. The information about the curvature of the space-time must be somewhere else. And here's where it is. We can specify the space-time completely equivalently by saying it's a differentiable manifold, and we specify at every point of the manifold a basis in the cotangent space, which belongs to a frame. This actually contains the information about the manifold. And you may wonder, well, how exactly? Well, you see, differentiable manifold, you put a coordinate system on it, and then in order to describe what the theta are, you have to write down a change of basis matrix A that gets you from the canonical basis of the d by dxi to the theta. And that matrix A contains all of the information about the metric. In fact, it's kind of the square root of the metric, as we will now see. So let's assume that we are given a differentiable manifold and that the theta I are given. So we have at every point of the manifold this cotangent basis. And how is it given? Well, it's given explicitly as a change of basis from the canonical one of the dx nu. So we have our differentiable manifold. We have an atlas on it, or just an individual chart. And then with that chart comes the basis, this canonical basis in the cotangent space. And then we are assuming here that the theta I are given. So we are assuming here that we can express the theta, these basis vectors, in terms of the canonical ones, namely through a function, a matrix valued function A mu nu of x. And theta is promised to be a frame. So we assume that this gives us a frame, which means that in that basis, the metric takes this form. It's just eta mu nu. So then the question is, if this is really an equivalent description of the space-time, then from these data only, so just from knowing that the theta form a frame, and from knowing that the theta are related to the canonical choice of basis vectors in the cotangent space through this matrix, just from these data, we should be able to reconstruct the metric in the traditional form. We should be able to reconstruct the metric in the canonical basis. Let's see if we can do this. Well, we use that the metric tensor G is the same no matter what coordinate system, no matter what basis in the tangent spaces you use. It's just one metric, right? It just takes different shapes depending on what basis you choose. So on one hand, we can write the metric tensor as this covariant 2 tensor that it is. It is just theta mu tensor theta nu, so covariant 2 tensor, and the coefficient function is just the eta mu nu. That's how the metric tensor looks when we use the frame basis. But we also know that these thetas can be expressed in terms of the canonical basis vectors. So we can substitute this into here and there. And then we obtain that the metric tensor is also eta mu nu, and then AA, because we apply this twice, once for the theta mu, once for the theta nu. So we get this matrix A twice, and then dxA and dxB. But now we have the metric tensor expressed in the canonical basis that comes with the coordinate system, the dxA and the dxB. And these are the coefficient functions. So this is now g mu nu of x in the canonical basis here. And from that, we can read off that the coefficient functions here in the canonical basis are these. So it is that, right? And so in that sense, we took the square root of g. The a, you need that a matrix twice, and then apply it to the eta mu nu, and you get that. In other words, the a is the diagonalizing change of bases from the canonical basis to the frame basis. So you can specify a space-time with its curvature by specifying the differentiable manifold, and then these frame bases, which implies you're giving these matrix functions. And from these matrix functions, you can re-obtain the metric. So indeed, these data, because they involve the A, are complete information about the metric and therefore about the space-time. So in other words, just knowing those functions, these matrix functions, these functions that describe what change of basis you have to do to diagonalize the metric, these data alone already describe the manifold. It requires some acrobatics here. What is this? Oh, I see. It was already up. Okay. I'm learning. Okay. So then, let's see. So we say, we saw that all the information about the space-time is encoded in this matrix here, this matrix-valued function. But then there's more than the metric that we're interested in. We're also interested in these coefficients that you may remember earlier. I will review them in a sec. You know, it's when you have a basis and you take the exterior derivative of that, then you go from one forms to two forms, and the C's are the coefficient matrix of that. So we have this coefficient matrix here. We have the connection one form, you know, the Christoffel symbols viewed as a one form. And we have the curvature two form. All of that information must be encoded in here, because this encodes the metric. And all of that is expressible in terms of the metric. So let's see how that works. Here we go. Okay, let's start with the orthonormal frame. So we assume that we are given here this matrix valued function of space and time, which describes the change of bases that is diagonalizing the metric. Then how do these coefficient functions determine these coefficients C? Remember, they are defined in the following way. You take an arbitrary basis, and then the exterior derivative of these basis vectors is a two-form. And every two-form is expandable in that basis of two-forms. And it has some expansion function, C, I, J, K. Remember that these coefficient functions play a role when you work with arbitrary bases, not just the coordinate bases. You see, if you work with the coordinate bases, with the canonical bases, that makes no sense. It's trivial, because then you have d of dxi, and that would be 0. But if the thetas are non-trivially related to the dxi, so they have a space-time dependence in front of them, then that's being picked up by that exterior derivative. And it turns out that when we express, for example, the Christoffel symbols in terms of the metric, if you remember, the formula was a bit more complicated when we choose frames. It involved also those C coefficients. All right, so how do we get these coefficients now? Well, we know that the exterior derivative of the basis vectors can be calculated directly, right? Because we have just the exterior derivative of this is the derivative acting on all of that. By the Leibniz rule, we have to differentiate this function and exterior differentiate that one form. But of course, the exterior derivative of that one form is 0. So we just get the exterior derivative of that. These are scalar functions. So what we obtain is that the exterior derivative of theta is given by the ordinary derivative, because it's just a scalar function for each coefficient I, j. We just get a comma here, and then the dxk veg dxj. So this has to match that. So this has to match this expression here. And we can plug in the thetas here. I mean, the relationship between the thetas and the dxi. And then we can compare coefficients. That's what we do here. And we obtain that the expansion matrix, CIAB of x, takes this form where we have the derivative of the A matrix. And then we have inverses of the A matrix as well. And as expected, if we choose the thetas not to be an orthogonal frame that diagonalizes the metric, but if we choose the theta to be simply the same as the dxj, so we haven't really changed bases, so that this is just, let's say, the identity, it's just a Kronecker delta, well, then that would vanish, right? Because the derivative of the Kronecker delta would vanish. And that's what we would expect, because d squared is equal to 0. So there wouldn't be any c's. And now we can also express, that's an older formula that I have to remind you of. There we had an expression for the Christoffel symbol in terms of the metric, as usual. But if you choose, if you make use of the freedom to choose bases arbitrarily in the tangent and cotangent space, then this matrix C shows its significance by showing up in here. Right? So we had that formula earlier, which said that if you work with an arbitrary basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces, then the relationship between the Christoffel symbols and the metric becomes more complicated. You see, if you stick with the canonical choice of bases, as is done in introductory general relativity, if you always work with the dxjs and the d by dxis, then the Christoffel symbol is expressed in terms of this only. That's the usual formula you will find in textbooks. But if we make the choice of using a frame here, then if we make the choice of just changing bases here, then we have to use this full expression where this C matrix occurs. But now we've gone further and said we want this to be not just any basis, but a basis in which G is diagonal, a basis in which the metric takes the form eta mu nu even. And in that case, the matrix that describes the metric is just eta mu nu, right? And therefore, it hasn't have a space-time dependence. All of its derivatives vanish, which means that the lower line now completely vanishes, because we have gij, k, gij, k, I. They all vanish, because they're all just eta mu nu's now. And the only thing that's left is up here. And also these g's are just etas in this case. Okay, so we can now calculate these gammas from the C, and the C we can calculate from the A. Remember, the A matrix is now the primary original carrier of the information about the space-time curvature. So from the A matrix, the change of basis matrix to that achieves the diagonalization of the metric, from that we calculate the C matrix. From that we can then express the Christoffel symbols. And once we have the Christoffel symbols, we can get the connection one form simply by declaring that K index here to be the index of a one form. And then we're just left with two indices. So omega ijx is the connection one form here, where the connection one form is calculated using the gamma that comes from that formula here. Okay, so now we have the connection one form, and we can now remember how the curvature is expressed in terms of it. Remember, we had two structure equations. The first one expressed the torsion two form in terms of the connection one form, and the second structure equation expressed the Riemann curvature two form in terms of the connection one form, and that was the equation. So, and that was, you know, it's true for whatever choice of coordinate system, for whatever choice of bases you make in the tangent and cotangent spaces. So now, having the connection one form in the frame language expressed through A, we can also express the curvature two form in terms of that, by taking the exterior derivative of the omega and then also the wedge product of omega with itself. If you remember the curvature tensor, if you go back to the canonical formulation where you use the d by dxi, dxj basis, and where we described the curvature in terms of the Riemann curvature tensor with its four indices, remember what the analog of that equation is? It's where the two lower indices are no longer considered the form, they're considered just being part of of the Riemann curvature tensor with its four indices, right? Because the omega is having two indices here, and two indices are suppressed because we call it the two form now. So if we rewrite all of that in the canonical form, what we would get is the Riemann curvature tensor here with its four indices, one upper, three lower indices. And then here what we would have is terms with the Christoffel symbols, and here terms with the square of the Christoffel symbols. Here we have two terms with derivatives of the Christoffel symbol and two terms with the square of the Christoffel symbol. And in this framework, the same equation is this. So the curvature two form can be expressed in terms of the connection in this way. It's somewhat simpler. So overall, what did we do? We started with the change of basis matrix that diagonalizes the metric. This is a matrix-valued function of space and time, and we claimed it contains all the information about the space-time, all of its curvature, and so on. Namely, first of all, it determines the thetas, the new bases. And then from that, we also get these coefficients, because we can calculate now the d theta, we get this coefficient c. Now, in terms of the coefficient c, we can express the Christoffel symbols, from which we get the connection one form, and then through the structure equation, to the second structure equation, that gives us the curvature two form. So in principle, we are ready to express general relativity in these terms now. Let's also, before we do, let's also recall some important identities for the torsionless case. So the first structure equation, I had just mentioned it, the first structure equation expresses the torsion in terms of the theta. That means just the absolute derivative of theta, which has these two terms. And in the torsionless case, as we assume is the case in nature, this is zero. So we can remember for later use that the d theta is actually omega ij veg theta. And then we have the second structure equation. It expresses the curvature in terms of the connection one form. That's the equation that we just had here this one. And then we also, these were definitions. If you like, these are definitions. This is the torsion. This is the curvature. These equations are non-trivial, but they don't describe physics. They describe mathematics. Remember, these were the two Bianchi identities. They arise because of diffeomorphism invariants. Mm-hmm. Do you have a question?
Sorry, I was just going to go back to the CIAB. So let's say if I was to plug in the basis vectors with the thetas, I would end up with commutation relations between the bases that would describe CIAB.
What do you mean by commutation relation?
Okay, so whenever you pick a non-coordinate basis, right, the information goes into the commutation, the bases don't no longer commute because you have picked a non-coordinate basis. Am I correct or not?
What do you mean by the bases don't no longer commute?
So if you express the commutation relation.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, so you're saying that.
Would be in terms of those CIBs. Those are the.
Yeah, well, that's right. Okay, I think what you're saying is this. I mean, we've been using the cotangent basis, right. But if you use the tangent basis,
yes.
Then ordinarily this is d by dxi. And the d by dxi commute with the d by dxj. Doesn't matter whether you partially differentiate first in one and then the other direction or the other way around. But now you get different tangent vectors that have coefficient functions in front of them. And that's right. So then we get a non-commutativity of the basis vectors in the tangent space. Yes.
And that
would be expressible. Yeah.
CIAB would be related to those structure constants, right?
You know what? That's an interesting exercise. Figure it out. Yes. Okay, so we're here. We have the two structure equations, which are the definition of torsion, and the second structure equation is the definition of curvature. Torsion, we assume it to be equal to zero. We get that equation here, and that's the curvature two form. Then the first Bianchi identity that follows from diffeomorphism invariance is this identity here, and then we also have that the absolute derivative of the curvature two form is zero. Again, diffeomorphism invariance. Now we are ready to apply all of this. Just a sec. And then we also had that in the case of orthonormal frames, and that was an equation that we had earlier, that is true. But we will get back to that very soon. So now let's use that formalism. And for the purpose of rewriting general relativity in that language. To keep things a little simpler, let's not consider the cosmological constant. Let's not consider the possibility of higher order curvature terms, which means that we just look at bare bones general relativity. So the action of gravity is then, from the previous lecture, it's 1 over 16 pi g. This factor is fixed by experiment. It's 1 over 16 pi g. And then the integral over the Ricci scalar, and then the volume form here. So this is the gravity action that describes everything that we know about gravity, except it doesn't describe why the universe is accelerating. For that, we need something that acts like a cosmological constant. Now, as we will later see, it doesn't have to be a cosmological constant because scalar fields can imitate the action of a cosmological constant. And there is some interplay between the cosmological constant and the potential of scalar fields. Okay, but as far as dynamic gravity is concerned, this is what matters. higher order curvature terms should be there because general relative, because quantum field theory induces them, but they are canonically, they have to be expected to be extremely small just by considering the units involved in this and the ultraviolet cutoff, as we saw in the previous lecture. So now we reformulate that gravitational action. For that, let's remember that if nu is a P form, then the Hodge star of it is an N minus P form, and it's obtained by lifting the indices of these coefficient functions using the metric, and then plugging that contravariant, P-fold contravariant tensor into the volume form, which is an N form, and then filling, you know, P slots of it, you are left with an N minus P form, and that's what the Hodge star is of the original P form. Remember, the Hodge star maps P forms into N minus P forms. So it maps lambda P into lambda N minus P. And using this, we see that what we have here actually is the Hodge star of R, because that's the volume form here. Right? Because if this nu here is actually a zero form, then you know all you get is the square root of g. You don't get any of these factorials. We don't get the epsilons, nothing. You don't get a lifting of the indices. You just get the square root of g. And so when you have a zero form times the volume form, then the Hodge star of that zero form is the volume form, is a maximum. No, it's not the volume form, it's a maximum degree form. You see, R is a zero form, star R is an N form. And it's the N form that's given here. Okay, it's just a nicer way to write this, because we don't have to spell out the square root of G here anymore. Okay, so the star R can directly be integrated over. And it doesn't refer to coordinate systems anymore. Here we are referring to a coordinate system. Here it doesn't. It's just the four form. Uh-oh. What happened? I see. I seem to have pressed wrong button. You see, when this hand goes too far down, then God knows what happens. I think I pressed on one of these things at the bottom bar, on the bottom bar. What is this? It doesn't grab it. Okay, so there we are. We had reformulated the gravitational action as the Hodge star of R. Now, let's express the gravitational action in terms of the bases and in terms of the curvature two form. Remember that ultimately the bases of the thetas contains all of the information. It's a little hidden because in order to actually specify the theta, you have to specify this change of basis matrix A. Right? And the change of basis matrix A is really containing the information in practical terms. But what it's describing is this abstract frame. Now, for that purpose, it will come in handy. Ooh, this thing moves on its own. For that purpose, it will come in handy to make the following definitions. We say that when we take two of these basis vectors in the tangent space, cotangent space, then we get a two form. If we take the Hodge star of that, we also get a two form. It's, of course, given by this. Using a frame, the Hodge star is actually a little easier, because all of those square root of g's are just one, because the g is the eta mu nu, right? So that simplifies things. So it looks like an h, but it's supposed to be, in the literature, it's supposed to be read as a Greek letter. And then it's the capital version of eta. So it's actually a capital eta. So this thing, which is supposed to be called the capital eta, as two indices alpha beta, is the Hodge star of these of two of the basis vectors, and then the capital eta with three indices is the Hodge star of the triple wedge product of basis vectors in the Cartesian space. And that's, of course, a one form. Lots of indices for a one form, but it is a one form, right? Because this is a three form, Hodge star of that makes it a 4 minus 3 equal to one form. And now the proposition is that the gravitational action here, the star R, can be expressed as the wedge product of this and the curvature 2 form. So in total, of course, this being a 2 form, that being a 2 form, the whole thing is a 4 form as it should be. And therefore, if this is true, so far this is just a claim, if it is true that the integrand here in the gravitational action can be written as eta mu nu omega mu nu, then the gravitational action can be written as 1 over 16 pi g, and then what? So the gravitational action is this, except there needs to be 1 over 16 pi g as a prefactor, and I just forgot to write it. I fixed it last night when I prepared this lecture, but because I was not on the internet here, it didn't update the file. So this is the previous version here. So the gravitational action is, of course, then this with the prefactor, right? So the star R is this, goes here, 1 over 16 pi g. So now we need to prove this. We need to prove that the gravitational action can be written in this form. And for that, we use that the curvature 2 form is obtained from the Riemann curvature tensor by contracting the last two indices. You know, remember, the Riemann curvature tensor is anti-symmetric in these two covariant indices. That's why we can view the Riemann curvature tensor as a 1-1 tensor-valued 2 form. So we just suppress the writing of that contraction here and then call it the curvature 2 form. So therefore, the curvature tensor, curvature 2 form, can be written in this way. Therefore, that expression can be written in this form. And here we have epsilons, there we have epsilons. And to see and what happens when you contract epsilon tensors with epsilon tensors, remember these are totally anti-symmetric things which flip sign whenever you flip two indices. And they are always plus 1, minus 1, or 0. And there is an identity that holds between them. And it would be too tedious to go through this. Let me just mention it, that this is a standard identity of the epsilon tensors. We plugged it in there. And we obtain that, indeed, this then is as claimed. Now, what we are up to is this. We now have the action, the gravitational action in this form. But what we will want is the gravitational equation of motion, the Einstein equation. How does the Einstein equation look in this new language? And for that purpose, let us let us look at an identity that we will need in the derivation of the Einstein equation. The proposition is that the absolute derivative of this eta mu nu being the wedge of two basis vectors, is vanishing. I don't know. Let's not spend too much time on this. I'm afraid of running out of time. See, I have to delicately press and push it upwards, this button. And the button doesn't really want that. OK. So let's record in our minds that that's true. Now comes the main proposition here, namely that the variation of the action, this action here, with respect to changes in the frame, and this is what we want, because now we are no longer differentiating the action with respect to the metric. That would be pointless. The metric, you know, is always eta mu nu. So no, we are now differentiating the action with respect to the thetas, the frame, because this is containing all the geometric information now. More accurately, of course, in practice, it's going to be the a mu nu matrix. But the point is, we are varying the action with respect to the theta mu. And so we have to do the variation of the star r, because that's the gravitational action now. We have to do the variation of this with respect to the theta. And so the claim is that the variation of star r, which is the gravitational action, is given by the variation of the basis vectors, veg this eta 1 form and the curvature 2 tensor, plus the exterior derivative of something. It doesn't really matter what it is in there. We will later see what it is, but it doesn't matter what it is, because that will give us just a boundary term, because we integrate over the action, will give us a boundary term. And since we are not varying by construction, we are not varying the theta at the boundary of the region that we consider, or maybe our region doesn't even have a boundary, then that a boundary term would vanish. So what would this imply? If this is true, what does it imply? Well, it implies that the gravitational action, and I multiply with 16 pi g so that we get rid of that prefactor there, so we just get this part here. It would imply that the gravitational action is the integral over this. So it's the integral, it's this integral here. And then, as we said, we get that because it's the exterior derivative by Stokes' theorem, we get that this is the integral over the boundary. But it has a variation in it, which vanishes at the boundary. So that term drops out. And we just have this here. And then we define something that we need for the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. Namely, now we define also the energy-momentum one form. We know the energy-momentum tensor. The energy-momentum tensor is a twofold a covariant tensor. It has two lower indices. But it's not anti-symmetric in them. It's, in fact, symmetric in the two lower indices. So it's definitely not a two-form. For that, we would need that it's anti-symmetric. But we can declare one of its indices as being the index of a one-form. And that makes sense. So we view now the energy-momentum tensor as an energy-momentum one-form, where it takes as an argument a tangent vector, because that's what a one-form asks for, and then it outputs a covariant vector. And how do we do that? We say that when we functionally differentiate the action with respect to the metric, we get the energy-momentum tensor as we know it. But now, it's no longer the metric with respect to which we are varying. We are varying with respect to the frame theta, because the frame theta contains the information about the space-time curvature. So if we vary the action with the frame now, then that gives us the energy-momentum form, one form. So this is just the analog of the equation that ds by dg is equal to t mu nu up to a prefactor of 1 half and the square root of g. And so you can view this as, you know, if you mentally put the d theta mu here to the left, ds by d theta mu, then you get that this is the energy momentum one form. The equation of motion, that is to say the Einstein equation, is then obtained by varying not just the gravitational or just the matter action, but the complete action of matter and gravity. So the Ricci scalar here and all of the standard model action in here, if we vary that with respect to the to the frame, then we obtain this equation here. We obtain from varying the matter, we obtain the star of T mu, and from varying the Riemann curvature scalar, which is this, varying it, we obtain that here, we obtain this expression here. You see, in principle, we should put here, we can divide this over here, then we get a 1 over 16 pi g, as we had before. And overall, we could put this also on that side, then we have that, this on that side, then we have that the sum of the two terms is equal to 0. And that's the statement that the total functional derivative with respect to the frame is equal to 0. See, this term is proportional to delta theta. That term is proportional to delta theta. Therefore, since this is true for all delta thetas, this plus that has to be equal to 0. Finally, we can make a definition, and we can say that we define that this expression here on the left-hand side, we can define to be the so-called Einstein tensor, or Einstein 2 form. And then what we obtain is the Einstein equation in this form. Sorry, it's the Einstein 1 form. So structurally, what we have here is the energy momentum tensor, but we view one of its indices as that of a 1 form. And the same for the Einstein tensor here. We view one of its indices as a 1 form. All this just so that we can view the metric as being eta mu nu everywhere. See, this thing needs to be down so that I can push it up again. Okay, let's see. Okay, so now we are ready to view general relativity as a gauge theory. First, let me explain why it's a gauge theory, and then give you a an idea of that, and then remind you of what a gauge theory is in particle physics, so that you see the connection there. Are you all already familiar with gauge theories? Probably not. So not all of you. Okay. All right, so general relativity as a gauge theory. Remember, the gravitational action is this, and I again forgot the factor of 1 over 16 pi g. So the Einstein equation can be written in this way, and the Einstein action in that way. And they are now the same in all coordinate systems. You see, the coefficient functions here do not depend on the coordinate system anymore. They're frozen. If you change coordinates, it doesn't change anything. And they are the same also no matter what choice of bases we choose in attention spaces, as long as they are diagonalizing bases. Remember from earlier that a frame, an orthonormal frame, a tetrad frame, is not unique. That's because if you have a basis that diagonalizes the metric, well, you can always do a Lorentz transformation and get another basis that also diagonalizes the metric so that it's eta mu nu. So the choice of frame is always only unique up to change of basis if the change of basis is a Lorentz transformation. So if we have our spacetime described by theta mu's, we can also describe it by theta tilde mu's related to the original basis vectors by this spacetime dependent Lorentz transformation, spacetime dependent change of basis, which is a Lorentz transformation. Now, you see, in special relativity, we have that the same is true. If you write down your theory in a Cartesian coordinate in Minkowski space, then you can rewrite the theory equivalently by changing your coordinate system by a global Lorentz transformation. Right? So you do a Lorentz transformation and you get new position and time variables and you get the same theory. However, imagine if in special relativity you made the Lorentz transformation space and time dependent. Then you would not get the same theory if you change coordinates. It would look very different. And the reason is that there are derivatives with respect to space and time in the Maxwell equations. They are space-time derivatives in the Klein-Gordon equation, in the Dirac equation, everywhere. If you had Lorentz transformations that depend on space and time, then these space-time derivatives would act on this space-time dependent Lorentz transformation, and the theory would have lots of extra terms with derivatives of the A in it, right? But now in general relativity, we see it's fine, because everything is taken into account. The theory is really absolutely the same. This is the same, that's the same, everything is the same. No matter which frame we use, we can freely choose the basis here. We can freely choose to do a Lorentz transformation and nothing will change. And how is that achieved? Well, remember that in general relativity, derivatives are not just ordinary derivatives anymore. They're covariant derivatives. They have these Christoffel symbols in there. It's a derivative plus Christoffel symbol stuff, right? And that Christoffel symbol stuff has dependence on that. So the ability in general relativity to do Lorentz transformations, not just globally, but locally, at every point in space, you get to choose a different Lorentz transformation. You should, of course, do that change in a differentiable way. But as long as you do that, you can choose your Lorentz transformation arbitrarily. And space and time, you can vary it. And general relativity will not care. It is a gauge theory under that. So we can view what we have achieved here as upgrading special relativity such that Lorentz transformations are no longer only allowed globally. So you'd have to do the same Lorentz transformation everywhere. No, in general relativity, you're allowed to do the Lorentz transformations locally because you can change your frame at every point, whichever way you want. And the price we had to pay, happily, was that we had to go from ordinary derivatives to covariant derivatives. And the consequence of that was that the covariant derivatives, which contained the Christoffel symbols, were actually describing not just flat space-time, but also curved space-time, because the Christoffel symbols didn't have to be trivial. So in other words, Einstein could have alternatively proceeded in the following way. He could have said, special relativity allows arbitrary global Lorentz transformations. What if we want local Lorentz transformations? Then we have to introduce covariant derivatives. We have to work with those Christoffel symbols, which means non-trivial parallel transport. At least we have to allow non-trivial parallel transport. Of course, Minkowski space is also a solution of general relativity. But in general, we will not have Minkowski space. We will have curvature. We will have gravity. And that's an example of the so-called gauge principle. If you have a theory that is invariant under global transformations, a global symmetry group, like the Lorentz transformations for special relativity, and then you make that a local symmetry, then you will have to mess with the derivatives, obviously. So you go from ordinary derivatives to covariant derivatives. And for that, you have to introduce then this affine connection. And that affine connection introduces a new force. And it turns out that not only gravity, but also electromagnetism, the weak force and the strong force, can be derived in the same way. You start with a theory that is allowing global symmetry transformations. And then you ask that theory to be modified such that it also allows local transformations of that form, local symmetry transformations. That, of course, messes with the derivatives. So you get something like the derivative becomes the ordinary derivative plus Christoffel symbols, plus an affine connection. which may or may not be trivial, but the point is it may not be trivial, and in general it isn't trivial, it will describe a new force. And then it's not gravity. It can be electromagnetism, it can be the weak force, can be the strong force. We don't have time for the details of this, but I've wrote up all the details of it in these lecture notes. Okay, so let me quickly go through it for electromagnetism, for example. Let's look at the Dirac field in special relativity. Its action is this. Remember, we had this before. This is the electron wave function. I mean, it's not wave function, it's the electron field. This is quantum field theory. Electron field, and here you have gamma matrices and the derivatives and so on. This theory, special relativity, has a global symmetry. Namely, imagine you take the psi, the field for the electrons, and you multiply it with e to the power I alpha. It's a complex field to start with. No harm in multiplying it with e to the power I alpha. And then, well, if you multiply psi with e to the power I alpha, clearly you multiply psi bar, which is the complex conjugate of it. Also, it has, let's say it's a complex conjugate of it. Then you multiply that automatically with e to the power minus I alpha. So clearly, you put a phase here, that means you put the inverse phase there, and so therefore the action remains the same under this global transformation. Global means I take this field psi of x, and I multiply it everywhere for all x in space-time. I multiply it with the phase e to the power I alpha, and then that cancels out with the e to the power of minus I alpha over here, because the e to the power I alpha can be moved through this. However, if the e to the power I alpha has a space-time dependence, if this alpha depends on space and time, then this will catch on that derivative. The derivative cares about that, right? Because if this is having an extra space-time dependence, then that matters. So that means the action gets changed if you do a local transformation. And we say if you gauge it locally. A transformation like that is called a gauge transformation. In general relativity, the gauge transformations are Lorentz transformations. In electromagnetism, as we will see, it is just a phase, which is an element of the U1 group, the unitary one group, right? It's just the phases, just complex numbers of modulus 1. Now, the gauge principle for electromagnetism is the following. It says, introduce a new field A mu of x, just out of the hat, just like in general relativity. The Christoffel symbols appeared afresh. It appeared new. So now introduce a new field A mu of x that transforms so as to absorb the extra term. So instead of saying that nature is described by this action, we say nature is described by that action. So we just postulated that maybe there is an extra field that we might call A mu. And then we postulate that under local transformations, that's e to the power I alpha of x, we postulate that under these local transformations now, the A field also transforms, namely the A field transforms into itself minus I d mu alpha of x. Why do we postulate that? We postulate that because if we introduce this A field and if we declare it to transform in this way under local gauge transformations, then in fact this action gives the same value before and after the gauge transformation, because this term becomes that term but with a minus I d mu alpha, and that's exactly the term that you also get up to a sign when you apply this d mu onto that. So therefore, these two terms cancel each other out, and the action remains the same before and after the gauge transformation. But we had to pay a price, and in hindsight, happily we pay that price. We pay the price that we had to introduce a new field A. A new field A that has particular properties under the gauge transformation. And as you may be aware, this is the electromagnetic field. So it plays exactly the same role as the Christoffel symbols in gravity. It's an affine connection. So that means that electrons are now no longer just freely moving around. No, they're exposed to the presence of this. And then, of course, one has to ask, well, what is the equation of motion for that? In the case of general relativity, the gauge transformations were local Lorentz transformations. We introduced the Christoffel symbols. Because of the Christoffel symbols, geodesics were modified. All of the equations of motion were modified because of the Christoffel symbols. But we also had to ask, what's the dynamics of the Christoffel symbols? What's the dynamics of curvature? Because the Christoffel symbols describe the non-triviality of parallel transport. The Christoffel symbols are one way of expressing that the space-time has non-trivial shape. And then we had to ask, well, what is the dynamics of the Christoffel symbols? That's described by the Einstein equation. Right? The Einstein equation is the equation of motion for the affine connection. You can also view it as the equation of motion of metric. But the metric and the affine connection are equivalent in general relativity. So in the electromagnetism case, the equivalent question is, if we introduce the AMU field, well then yes, the electrons will behave differently because of the presence of that field. So the Dirac equation is modified. But how do the AMU fields behave? What is their dynamics? And the answer to that is, well, you have to come up with an action for them. And then ask, once I have that action, I differentiate, functionally differentiate, set that equal to zero for classical theory, and I get equations of motion. And what are they? Well, they are the Maxwell equations. They are the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations. The homogeneous ones are Bianchi identity. And remember for gravity too, we got the Einstein equation, but we also got Bianchi identities that are automatically obeyed. And similarly for electromagnetism. There is a generalization of this. You see here, the e to the power I alpha of x, it's just complex numbers. And they commute. But you could also have here a complex matrix. You could have that the psi have, let's say, indices from 1 to 2 or 1 to 3 or something. So this could be a column vector. And then you could have a global rotation, a global U3, unitary 3 by 3 matrices, or SU3, and then here the inverse. And again, the theory would be invariant under this because the derivative doesn't catch on it unless if that unitary matrix is space-time dependent. Then the space-time derivatives catch on that in exactly the same way. And the formulas become a bit more complicated because now we have non-commutativity. It becomes, in fact, more similar, even more similar to gravity. Because in gravity, the local gauge transformations are local Lorentz transformations, and they don't commute either. And so you can go through this, and that's what I'm explaining here in the remaining slides. So you can go through this and then find that for n equal to 2, you get the weak force, and for n equal to 3, you get the strong force. So if you, instead of just working with a phase, a U1 phase, or you can work with SU2 or SU3, special unitary 2x2 or special unitary 3x3 matrices, then you have to introduce more affine connections, and these affine connections then describe the weak force and the strong force. You might think, of course, oh, okay, how about n equal 4, 5, and so on? It has been tried, of course, but we haven't seen those forces. There's a huge program of research of grand unification where the idea is that maybe the U1 of electromagnetism, the SU2 of the weak force, and the SU3 of the strong force are all subgroups, are all arising from subgroups of a larger symmetry group that needs to be gauged. But it's tough. Experiments have so far pretty much ruled out everything that could be tested. And And there's always stuff that is so contrived that you can't test it, but it's frustrating because it would be very nice if there was just one big gauge principle for everything. There's one big difference though between the gravity and the non-gravity gauge principles, which is that only in gravity do we have a metric. The gravity is external degrees of freedom. It's space-time degrees of freedom, whereas all the other degrees of freedom are internal, where you have an index, for example, for the Dirac field, an index that's what is called an isospinner index. It doesn't transform at all with the Lorentz transformations or with changes of coordinates or anything like that. It's an internal index. It's scalar as far as relativity is concerned. Whereas relativity is, of course, all concerned about the space-time. So there's a big difference in that regard. Okay, and then at the end, I'm totally out of time here. At the end, I do a little calculation just to show you explicitly that as we go from Lorentz transformations to infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, we obtain that the infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, so Lorentz transformations that are Kronecker delta plus something small, are Lorentz transformations if, when you write the epsilon with lower indices, they are antisymmetric. And that's what we found out for the connection one form. The connection one form, if you use this frame, has the property that it is antisymmetric, which means that the connection one form, as we have been claiming for a while, are actually, they're not tensor-valued one forms. They are infinitesimal Lorentz transformation-valued one forms. That's what the connection one form is. We had this before. I just thought I'd write it up explicitly this time here. Whew. Yeah, I'm sorry, I had to rush a little bit at the end, but it seemed that otherwise I would have had to rush at the beginning. It's a lot of material there. Okay, but all the details are in the lecture notes anyway.